This paid program may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Leaders speak on meeting their mission and making a difference. Today, governments are facing very serious, seemingly intractable public management issues that go to the core of effective governance and leadership, testing the very form, structure, and capacity required to meet these problems head on. The leaders are responsible for envisioning, shaping, and safeguarding the future, creating clarity amidst uncertainty. This is no small feat and is made increasingly difficult in the 21st century, where rapid, unforeseen change seems to be the only constant. Given the climate of uncertainty for today's government leaders, it is imperative to work toward executing their mission and the mission of their agencies with strategic intent. Strategic intent focuses on an organization's visions, goals, and objectives necessary to achieve its mission. It is marked by the clarity of focus, a desired end, a flexibility of means, with criteria used to chart progress. It represents a need to think ahead and plan backward from an envisioned future, making it clear how to take effective action in the present. Over the years, I've brought you insights from many government executives who, in meeting their mission, are ultimately making a difference. This Leaders Speak edition brings together a select group of government executives who manifest the leadership and commitment needed to meet their varied missions. This show offers merely a sampling from our vast library of conversations with dedicated public servant leaders from a wide variety of disciplines. Scientist, physician, researcher, and wouldn't you know, a motorcycle enthusiast. The first leader who speaks to us about the mission of his agency and making a difference is Dr. Francis Collins, Director of the National Institutes of Health.
We are celebrating our 125th anniversary. NIH, its original form, which was a hospital particularly focused on mariners who had a lot of problems with tuberculosis, founded in 1887. And that point was in Staten Island. It gradually moved to Washington and ultimately to Bethesda, and has been really our nation's major investment in biomedical research now for many decades, the largest such institution in the world. There are about 17,000 full-time employees plus contractors that work for the National Institutes of Health, a wide variety of skill sets. Many of them are distinguished scientists with doctoral degrees, but lots of other people work on the campus in Bethesda and in the other units that we operate, including one of our institutes in North Carolina, some other activities in Baltimore, and others in Montana. So we are scattered a bit, but the main focus is on our campus right up here on Wisconsin Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland.
Dr. Francis Collins, director of NIH, notes science is not a 100-yard dash. It's a marathon run by a relay team that includes researchers, patients, industry experts, lawmakers, and the public. Dr. Collins outlines how basic research promoted a revolution in the diagnosis, treatment, and prevention of diseases, and what NIH is doing to advance biomedical research.
NIH spends about 53% of its budget on basic research, and that would be defined as research on some aspect of biological processes that does not have an immediate implication or application to a disease. But you have to understand how life works at the most fundamental level before you can really understand what disease is all about. So this is the foundation of everything we do. And over the course of many decades, the basic science research, which has led to no less than 135 Nobel Prizes for NIH-funded grantees, is the way in which we've often then gotten to the next level of understanding about a biological process, and that in turn has led to insights about disease, which are now making big differences clinically. If we want to continue to see those medical advances going forward 10, 20, 30 years from now, we need to be doing the basic science now that is going to provide that foundation.
This foundation illustrates that basic discovery and the development of therapies go hand in hand. It's about understanding the genesis of disease at the most fundamental level. Collins continues.
Basic science, trying to understand at the fundamental level, what are the causes of various rare diseases? Rare diseases collectively affect about 26 million Americans, and there are about 7,000 of these rare diseases. In the space of just the last 10 years, we've uncovered, using basic science strategies, the molecular basis of about 4,700 of those diseases. Just breathtaking, the rate at which this insight has been coming forward. Of course, that's useful in terms of getting a grasp on what the diseases are all about, but what you really want is to translate that into an intervention. Only about 250 of those diseases currently have any treatment at all.
In the end, Dr. Collins and his team at NIH make a difference when they're turning discovery into action, which, though necessary, is quite risky.
By having now made those basic discoveries, we're poised to be able to translate that into action. And that is, in fact, a major focus of a new center at NIH, the National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences. There are a number of steps that you want to follow once you understand the molecular basis of a disease. They're complicated, they're failure-prone, they're risky. But we know increasingly how to do that. And that's a great example of how, at the present time, the basic science informs the translation. I should say, this is also a virtuous circle, that when you make an observation at the basic level that leads you to clinical insight, sometimes when you try this out clinically, you learn something about the basics as well, and you go around that virtuous circle to your benefit over and over again.
How does the new National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences work to make this all reality? Collins elaborates.
So NCATS, this National Center for Advancing Translational Sciences, was very much founded on the need to try to identify what are those systematic bottlenecks that cause this process to be so challenging. And it is. The average time it takes to go from a good idea about a new treatment to getting that drug approved is 14 years. The failure rate is well over 99%. Now, an engineer looking at a pipeline like that would say, come on, there must be something better you could do here to improve success and shorten the time. And that's what NCATS aims to do, to look systematically in a way that no single project focus would achieve. Where are the bottlenecks? Where are the things where we lose momentum, where time goes by more than it should, where failure rates are way too high? Could we take some of the new science that's coming forward in the last few years and really re-engineer that pipeline? That's what we're trying to do.
Today, technological advances are driving science. We need to look no further than the cost of DNA sequencing to see this dynamic at work. The cost curve for sequencing is dropping at a breathtaking rate. Sequencing speeds has increased even faster than computer processing speed. Dr. Collins elaborates on the implications of this trend.
If you want to pick an area of technology that just takes your breath away in terms of the speed of its progress, it would be DNA sequencing. That first human genome sequence that I had the privilege of overseeing, the team that managed to pull this off, cost about $400 million when it was completed in 2003. You can now get your human genome sequenced for about $7,000. Think about that, 400 million down to 7,000 in the space of just about 9 years, and the cost continues to plummet. So we will, in the next 3 to 4 years, certainly achieve this goal that many people thought was a bit overly audacious, namely the $1,000 genome, but we're well on the way to achieving that. How will that change things? Well, it already is changing things in cancer, increasingly as part of research studies. And it won't be long before this finds its way into the management of cancer in general, is the desire to know in any given individual's cancer exactly what has gone wrong in those cancer cells that's causing them to grow faster than they're supposed to. Because cancer is a disease of the genome. And now we have the chance to look comprehensively each individual at a time in what's gone wrong there and what you might want to do about it. Because knowing that, you can then choose the right combination of targeted therapies that are not one size fits all, but are designed for that person's specific molecular signature. That's just one example. Certainly all of us in the next decade, we'll probably have the chance to have our complete genome sequences placed into our medical record. That will give insights into what you might be at risk for in the future. It will give insights into, if you fall ill, what drug should be used for you and what dose, because individual differences can be predicted by a study of the DNA. So it is going to transform the way we approach many medical problems, but not overnight. There were some overly optimistic predictions that this was going to happen in the blink of an eye. It takes a lot of hard work, a lot of research, a lot of driving the cost down to make those things come true.
So why is the work that NIH does so important? Here's Dr. Collins.
I would say there has never been a better time in all of history than right now to come and join this enterprise. We are unraveling mysteries that have puzzled us for all of human history. We're poised to take that information to the next level in terms of preventing and treating disease. We have the chance to bring the basic and the clinical aspects of research together in a very tight connection and a virtuous circle. This would be the moment if you're in any way inclined to get involved in a great detective story that has great answers, come and join the biomedical research team. We've got stuff for you to do.
Some time ago, I had the pleasure of speaking with one of the world's leading scientists and authorities in the area of immunology and infectious diseases. Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, spoke with us about the organization he has led for over 25 years. He is an eloquent communicator who truly follows his principle, precision of thought, and economy of expression when explaining complex scientific issues.
The rules that I use when I talk to the public about science is don't try to impress anybody with how smart you are. Just be clear. People really need to understand what it is that you're talking about. So speak in common, plain English. Don't beat around the bush. Say what it is that you want to say. And if it requires an explanation, make it brief and make it clear and make it accurate. So I use the terminologies precision of thought and economy of expression. Know what it is that you want to say and say it in as few words as possible.
Dr. Fauci knows of what he speaks.
Well, I first came to the NIH back after my internship and residency in internal medicine. I trained at the New York Hospital Cornell Medical Center, and I wanted to do a fellowship in a combination of immunology and infectious diseases. At that time, human immunology was still in its infancy as a discipline, but it was very exciting. I also was very interested in infectious diseases and its impact on global health. Came to the NIH, did a 3-year fellowship in combined infectious diseases and clinical immunology. In fact, I've have my boards in actually 3 specialties, internal medicine, infectious diseases, and clinical immunology and allergy, even though fundamentally I'm a clinical infectious disease person who looks at immunological research related to the host-microbe interaction. And I did that starting after my chief residency, came down here and worked my way from being a senior fellow to a senior investigator to a laboratory chief. And then in 1984, I became the director of the Institute. What I'm doing is very exciting, and it constantly changes. So it was a constellation of events that occurred that got me where I am and keeps me where I am.
Dr. Fauci's passion and singular focus may have kept him in place, but his work and leadership continues to have a global impact.
Well, the NIAID is the leading funder of basic biomedical research in malaria in the world. So we have a large responsibility that we take very seriously in doing both the fundamental and clinical research and understanding everything from the fundamental pathogenesis of malaria to the developing of a pipeline of drugs. We have some good drugs for malaria, particularly the artemisinin derivatives when used in combination. We do not have a malaria vaccine, and that's a very, very high priority to develop a malaria vaccine. You know, approximately 1 million people, about 890,000 people a year die of malaria. So this is a great deal of disease burden and death that needs to be addressed. You can control malaria by a variety of other ways besides a vaccine. I mean, there's vector control, there's bed nets that are impregnated with insecticides, there's prophylaxis of pregnant women since they are very vulnerable to serious effects of malaria, there's the spraying of indoor huts. So there are many ways to control it, but NIAID is responsible for understanding everything from the pathogenesis or how the disease works, but importantly, in developing a pipeline of drugs and a vaccine.
To better understand the work that Dr. Fauci and his team does that makes a difference, he offers us a brief overview of the fundamentals of vaccinology and the relationship between discovery and development.
Well, first of all, let's start off with the definition of a virus. There are virus and bacteria and parasites. Viruses are one of the pathogens, as it were, which is in a virus. It's not a free-living microbe because it requires another cell for it to survive and replicate, but it's made up of either DNA or RNA. There are RNA viruses and there are DNA viruses. And what it has is the ability to co-opt functions of a cell to replicate itself, and by doing that, it generally causes disease. An example of influenza virus replicates, it binds to the surface of respiratory cells, enters the cells, replicates, causes inflammation and damage to the epithelium, and that's why you wind up coughing and sometimes getting serious pneumonia. Polio does the same thing with the nervous system. HIV/AIDS does the same thing with the immune system. So they attack different tissues of the body, but they cannot live outside of cells. There are many viruses for which we have developed successful vaccines. The fundamental principle of vaccinology is to expose a person to a weakened or killed form of a microbe. In this case, let's call it a virus, such as polio or measles, so that the body can mount an immune response so that when you actually get exposed to the real microbe or virus, that you will then have already a big head start on mounting an immune response that could protect you against disease. The principles of vaccinology are based on the concept that the body has the capability of responding adequately to a particular virus in question. So even though people get sick with polio, some get paralyzed, people get sick with measles and smallpox, some of these people die, at the end of the day, most of the people mount an immune response that clears the virus from the body and leaves you with long-lasting protective immunity against subsequent challenge. So the whole philosophy and the strategy of vaccinology is to expose the person in a harmless way to either a part of or a killed virus that doesn't harm them, but that mounts an immune response that ultimately allows that person to protect themselves when they get exposed.
Autoimmune diseases, asthma, and other immune-mediated disorders are significant causes of chronic disease and disability in our country. Dr. Anthony Fauci describes research efforts in immunology, highlighting the advances in our understanding of the mechanics underlying these diseases and in the development of strategies to detect, prevent, and treat them, illustrating further how his work makes a difference.
I think the answer to that question relates very much to the relationship between fundamental basic research and the application of that research. The NIAID is responsible in large part, not exclusively, but in large part, with studying the intricacies of the immune system. And the immune system is the body's protective mechanism, which when it works right, it protects you against infections, against certain cancers, against outside threats. When it goes awry, then you get immune-mediated diseases, the most common of which are hypersensitivity diseases or autoimmune diseases in which the body's immune system starts to attack its own tissues. We see that with rheumatological diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, systemic lupus erythematosus. We see it in transplantation rejection. We see it in asthma when you respond to an outside antigen in a very inappropriate manner that causes inflammation and sometimes symptoms and damage to tissues. We at NIAID study the intricacies of the immune system, particularly how the immune system is regulated. once you know how it's regulated, then you could develop interventions in the form of drugs to modulate that to treat and prevent diseases that are of immune-mediated nature.
Here's Dr. Anthony Fauci on the application of new scientific breakthroughs, such as biotechnology of genomics, transforming the way vaccinology is performed.
Well, we have seen over the past few decades an explosion in the technology of genomics. Our ability to sequence microbes years ago, not too many years ago, to sequence a single microbe would often take a year or so. We can do it in hours now, less than a day. So you can have a library of information, and that's you get genomics, and then you get informatics, and then proteomics, and you could do all kinds of things, words that people are not used to hearing, which means that in a very rapid fashion, you can get the molecular makeup of a microbe. You could understand the vulnerable points in the gene of that microbe that codes for certain proteins that's responsible for pathogenesis, things that are susceptible to therapeutic intervention, areas of the genome that code for proteins that are important for vaccines. So the genomic revolution has had a major positive impact on our ability to develop vaccines.
Up next, leaders speak on making a difference in the face of fiscal and budgetary realities when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. Is there a recipe for successful cross-agency collaborations that are enduring? Or is each initiative so dependent on context and personality that there's no way to offer general principles of success? Well, an IBM Center report by Dr. Jane Fountain, Implementing Cross-Agency Collaborations, a Guide for Federal Managers, offers advice on successful cross-agency relationships. Fountain says there's, in fact, a recipe for success, but it depends on the number of factors. Go to businessofgovernment.org, download Jane Fountain's report, and find out. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Leaders speak on meeting their mission and making a difference. In the previous segment, we explored the efforts of two public servant leaders in advancing medicine and basic research and how they are meeting their mission and, most of all, making a difference. Now we turn from making a difference advancing healthcare and basic research to tackling the fiscal and budgetary realities of today. The U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, works with Congress to better manage government resources for a more sustainable future while mitigating risks that can compromise the nation's security, health, and sovereignty. I had the pleasure of speaking with Gene Dodaro, Comptroller General of the United States and leader of the GAO, on the near and long-term challenges affecting the U.S. federal government budget.
For years, GAO has done long-range simulations of the federal government's fiscal path in order to illustrate what the long-term effects may be of policy decisions, but also changes such as demographics and others. And even before this last recession, you know, we warned that the federal government was increasingly coming along a unsustainable fiscal path. Deficits and debt were accumulating over time. Now, the long-term fiscal position of the federal government is really being driven by changing demographics, as I mentioned, the aging of our society and more people going on the Social Security rolls and also the Medicare, Medicaid rolls. So this demographic wave will hit these entitlement programs over the next few years, and rising health care costs. Those are the two primary drivers. Now, the Budget Control Act of 2011, earlier this year, has improved federal government's situation. It calls for $2.1 trillion of cuts between 2013 and 2021. And this will help improve the situation in the short term. But even with these changes in the longer term, there's still a serious issue that needs to be dealt with.
Along with supporting Congress and making necessary budget trade-offs, Dodaro outlines key strategic goals for GAO and how GAO seeks to make a difference.
We've set broad goals, and the goals are rooted in some of the constitutional responsibilities of the Congress. For example, we want to provide timely and quality service to the Congress and the federal government to address current and emerging challenges to the well-being and the financial security of the American people. And this includes everything from health care to education to transportation, et cetera, across the full breadth of the federal government's responsibilities to help achieve this broad goal. And also the second goal is to address the challenges to changing security threats and the challenges of global interdependence. And this includes areas in the national defense, homeland security, international affairs, for example. Third broad goal is to help the government transform itself to improve its programs and activities to meet 21st century challenges. Our last and final goal is to improve ourselves on a continuous basis and to make sure that we are an organization that has the capacity to deliver on its mission, but to continuously improve ourselves in doing so.
Jean Todaro, Comptroller General of the United States, understands that pursuing these very important goals come with a host of challenges.
It's very important for us always to work on the areas of highest priority for the Congress and key national important issues. Second, like a lot of federal agencies right now, there are budgetary challenges that we're all going to be facing across federal government. GAO is no exception to that. And so we're working through those issues very carefully to make sure that we maintain the quality of our work to Congress, work on items of highest priority, and also to make sure that we're minimizing any adverse effects on the very dedicated and talented GAO workforce. Thirdly, Michael, I'd say a big challenge is succession planning, because we need to have the right skilled workforce, and we need to have the right people in the right job. That's about 75% of success, and so I spent a lot of time dealing with that challenge.
Through its high-risk list, Todaro explains that GAO makes a difference, highlighting longstanding managerial and operational changes facing federal government and agencies today, and what can be done about them.
We've been creating the high-risk list since 1990, and it was to identify problems before they reach crisis proportions. Initially, we started out identifying areas subject to waste, fraud, and abuse and mismanagement in the federal government, and the programs evolved now to also include areas in need of broad-based transformation. There are currently 30 areas on the list. They include in the classic areas of potential fraud and abuse, for example, the Medicare program and the Medicaid program, where there are large amounts of improper payments that the federal government has to deal with, as well as the states dealing with the Medicaid program, for example. In the transformation area, there's a need to modernize the financial regulatory system. Transformation and implementation of the Department of Homeland Security is on the list as well. There are sets of issues that are on the list that are dealing with agencies or issues that are in sort of precarious financial situations, the financial condition of the United States Postal Service, for example, the National Flood Insurance Program, the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation are all on the high-risk list because of their challenges in the financial area. Now, we work very carefully with each of the agencies that are on the list to identify what progress is being made in order to come off the list eventually. There needs to be leadership commitment. There needs to be a good plan that's resourced properly. And then, importantly, there needs to be demonstration of progress in actually fixing the items. We're also engaged in regular meetings between the agencies on the high-risk list, OMB, and GAO, and we meet on a regular basis, and the very high-level officials from the agency and OMB are involved. Deputy Director for Management Jeff Zients and at least the deputy or head of the agency is involved in the discussions, and I personally participate in those meetings in order to make sure that we're bringing all the resources to bear and identifying what needs to be done to ensure progress in these areas. So it's a very important initiative. And I believe that we also, you know, I discussed some of these issues with the Congress as well, and our teams do, to make sure that in those areas where there's legislative need for reform to fix the high-risk area, that the Congress has benefit of our insights as well.
Todaro underscores GAO's role in eliminating improper payments that makes a difference in this era of fiscal constraint. An improper payment is any payment that should not have been made. Here's Todaro.
An improper payment is any payment that should not have been made. It could have been for ineligible recipient, not for an approved service. It might have been for an item that was never received. It could be an overpayment or an underpayment. And so it's an area where there is a lot of activity. You know, the volume of the federal government's payments in many of these areas, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, or in other large programs, is very high. So the likelihood of errors can occur. The total rate that's been identified is a little under 5% of payments in this area. And there are billions of dollars that occur in this area. What we've done is first have recommendations that help quantify improper payments. Before, the requirements for implementing financial audits in the federal government, there was not a systematic quantification of improper payments. So we helped, and along with the inspector generals and others, of implementing the financial audit requirements in the 1990s and preparing financial statements and having them audited, began surfacing this issue to make sure that the improper payments were being quantified. So that was step number one. Then we worked with the Congress and got legislation passed in 2002 to require the quantification across government and the reporting of these issues. And then we advised the Congress, and they strengthened the laws and requirements for reporting on this area and made sure the reporting occurred at proper levels and that agencies had actions plans going forward. The administration's been active in this area as well, helping set goals that need to be pursued to drive down the payments. It's not enough to just measure them. It's been then use that information in order to deal with them, and both in recoveries of payments that have been made, but importantly to prevent them from occurring in the first place. And the application of new technologies is really critical to that. So we've made some other suggestions in that regard and have looked at agencies' areas. So this is an area, it's a lot amount of money, $100 billion or more, and it is an area where both the Congress and the administration have been focused on it. And so I expect this to see improvements and better results going forward.
In expecting to see improvements and better results going forward, Dodaro explains how public managers can help elected officials manage through these challenges.
Federal managers really can step up during these period of times and really help elected officials in a number of ways. First is pay attention to the people. Pay attention to the workforce. When there are difficult challenges, the workforce can feel devalued and dispirited when there are difficult changes, and you need to engage the people in the process to help them, you know, to manage the changes, not let the changes manage them going forward. And so trying to work with the workforce. Secondly, is to step up efforts to fix these high-risk or long-standing problems in the agencies that drain resources unnecessarily away from productive means. There are a lot of problems in the management infrastructure of government or opportunities to provide strengthened roles to become more efficient, a better use of technology, and to deal with these, improving the capacity of the governments to meet these challenges and eliminate wasteful activities and unnecessary departures from what would be productive use of resources. So public managers can do a lot in this process, and they can also offer up suggestions and alternative ways of dealing with these issues that can minimize any adverse or unintended consequences because of their deep knowledge of the programs and activities.
The profound demographic and systemic forces at work in the early 21st century have shaken the core belief that the programs administered by the U.S. Social Security Administration will be there for future generations. It is at this critical juncture in the history of SSA that it seeks to enhance its ability to meet its mission, eliminate claims backlog, reverse negative trends, improve services, and demonstrate the nexus between adequate funding and the ability to deliver real and measurable progress.
Well, certainly when I accepted the job, the biggest obvious challenge was getting ready for the baby boom. As I started, the National Academy of Sciences had just issued a report saying that the agency was woefully unprepared for the baby boom and needed to really improve electronic services in order to manage the workloads and those sorts of things. And then I came in, the agency was rejecting most of that advice, and I read that report and said, no, these people are pretty much right. And it became part of the blueprint for moving us forward. So we moved to get the best usability that we possibly could to reach out to new constituencies, and we've been very successful. The University of Michigan measures private sector and public sector electronic services. Most of the big organizations in this country use it. We have the three best in the federal government, four of the top five, and we do better than Yahoo and Google and places that most people would think would be better than we are. And so we're very proud of that. And it's allowed us to be much more efficient and to manage the baby boom. And that's why we did it. But it turned out that if we hadn't done that when we did it, we would have just been rocked back on our heels by the recession. Dealing with the added workloads of the recession has been hard enough as it is. But if we did not have the electronic services, we would have been moving backwards in terms of most of the metrics for serving the public. And we were able, despite the increase in workloads and the last 2 years, very severe budget cuts, we are still improving in terms of most key service metrics to the public. And the electronic services has really been a pivotal part of that.
Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, spoke to me about how, despite the increasing workload and 2 years of very severe budget cuts, SSA is still improving how it does business.
As you get toward the end of your term, you know, you do think a little bit, you know, what have I contributed? You know, have I lived up to my own expectations? And I think one of the areas where I've been able to make a significant contribution was to change the legislative strategy when it came to discussions about funding. The agency is a wonderful place, and they are some of the most motivated, can-do people possible. But I think for a long time, we went up to the hill with that sort of can-do attitude, and we really ended up hurting the agency and the people that we serve, because we'd go up and we'd ask for what we thought we needed, and the responsible people, well, that's nice, but can you do it with that minus 5%? And the answer is, well, it would be a lot harder, but we're a can-do agency, we'll do it. So we did not want to tell the Congress what would not happen if they did not fund at a certain level. And we are so big and so complicated, we developed not only the very prominent disability hearing backlog, but lots of other backlogs, too, on work that is still very important to get done on a timely basis. And that was not discussed the way that it should have been. So going back to what I said earlier about clear, candid communication with employees, I may be wrong, but I'm consistent because I believe in exactly the same thing when it comes to communicating with Congress. And for a while, that worked extremely well. We had a 3-year stretch where we did, I believe, on average, better than any of the other large domestic agencies. Congress heard the concerns, decided we were right, and responded. The last couple of years, you know, it's been mostly across the board funding, and I think that hurts us disproportionately for a couple of reasons. One is Congress put what was essentially operating money into the Recovery Act and then didn't count that as part of our baseline going forward. So we started at a lower baseline than comparable other federal agencies. Second, we don't really have very much other than buildings and people in terms of expenses. So if you're a grant-making agency, you might not like it, but you can do 3% fewer grants and 3% less money, and you've got some flexibilities in responding to cuts. We don't have those. We have entitlements. We have people, we have buildings. And so what is happening, and I think Congress still is having trouble understanding the wreckage that it's creating, with these kinds of reductions in staffing, we have no real choice but to consolidate facilities. And so they all think that they've done the right thing when they vote at the funding level, and they talk about government becoming leaner, more innovative, and efficient. But then when you do the things to become leaner and more efficient, if it affects their districts, they become extremely upset. We're having a lot of unpleasant conversations with Congress because we are consolidating facilities. And it's not just the money we save by consolidating facilities. We can't hire, we can't backfill employees. You know, we have to take hundreds of millions of dollars out of the budget, and it's hard. And so it's been a very difficult couple of years.
Keeping on that line of thought around service enhancement, Michael Astrew explains the potential benefits of health IT, applying it innovatively to enhance services.
So what we were been very excited by health IT from the get-go, and the Recovery Act encouraged us to spend approximately $25 million getting ready for that. So we've done pilots. We work with MedVirginia. We work with a couple other of the smaller entities around the country that are pretty much already there in terms of supplying electronic medical records. And it's worked extremely well from our vantage point in time. It's not quite as well as we dreamed in the beginning because, you know, we discovered that what was coming over the transom had a lot of extraneous reimbursement information and other information we had to screen out, that we had to do some redesigns of our business processes to handle some of the information that was coming in somewhat differently. But even with those fixable problems, we were cutting our review times by probably in the neighborhood of about 40%. And I think we can do better over time. The problem for us right now is just very few insurers are there yet. It's coming, but it's painfully slow. I mean, there was tens of billions of dollars in the Recovery Act provided to the private sector to accelerate this. And it's coming, but it's slow. When health IT comes, your head is going to snap back and say, it's amazing how much things are changing. And it will be changing in a good way. So I'm excited about it. I mean, I'm a little frustrated because 5 years ago, I thought all the improvement would happen on my watch, and that's not going to happen. You know, at this point, it's going to be 3 more years probably before it's common enough in the private sector to affect most of what we're doing. But we're getting there.
Michael Astrew, Commissioner of the Social Security Administration, on his legacy and the future.
You know, I jokingly refer to legacy as the L word around the office. And the reason for that is I think in a lot of agencies, because I've spent almost 14 years in the federal government now, and I've seen a lot of agency heads. And I've seen, as you get to the end, sometimes a sense that, oh, my God, I have to establish my legacy, and things are raced out at the end, and they don't work very well, and they're actually counterproductive. And a lot of times people actually, ironically, end up with a negative legacy because they're too worried about legacy. So my feeling is I think that we've done some very important things on my watch. I think the fast tracking of the disability programs I take a lot of pride in. Introducing high quality electronic services I take a lot of pride in. I think moving a long way to change the direction in terms of the physical IT infrastructure to make sure that the checks continue to go out on a regular basis, that's incredibly important. We have some other longer term projects that won't be finished on my watch that we started. I'm proud of that because, you know, some of these things take a long time. We're using a 1938 tool that labor stopped updating effectively in 1977 for a lot of our vocational decisions. And I think commissioners were discouraged about taking that on because it's a very long-term and expensive project. So even though, even under duress with a lot of competing demands for resources, I just thought it was important to start that. So we have started that. We've been working on it for a number of years. We probably won't see any benefit in the agency for 2 more years. But I think it's important that we replace the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. So there's a whole set of things that, you know, we've done or brought fairly far forward that I think, you know, for better or for worse, will be my legacy. And I think in the last year, my feeling is the focus needs to be on bringing those as far along as possible, driving the backlogs down as far as possible. And it really isn't a smart thing to start anything tremendously new and ambitious in your last year unless you absolutely need to do it. And you can say with a lot of confidence, the next commissioner will want to come along and finish the same thing.
Leaders speak on meeting missions and making a difference when this special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns. Pundits warn about the fiscal cliff, but federal agencies nearly every year hold up the budgetary sky while walking on the edge of a cliff. It's called the world of continuing resolutions and potential government shutdowns. The IBM Center report, The Cost of Budgetary Uncertainty, Analyzing the Impact of Late Appropriations by Dr. Phil Joyce, examines the impact of late budgets on the efficiency and effectiveness of government operations. To find out more about the cost of budgetary uncertainty, go to businessofgovernment.org. That's businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to a special edition of the Business of Government Hour. Leaders speak on meeting their mission and making a difference. From enhancing economic opportunities for agricultural producers, to protecting the nation's food supply, to improving nutrition and health, the U.S. Department of Agriculture supports programs that touch the lives of all Americans every day. Here's its Deputy Secretary, Dr. Kathleen Merrigan.
It was created in 1862 by an act of Congress and signed into law by Abraham Lincoln, the president, and we refer to it as the People's Department. It's a wonderful place. It's a very big place. We have three big buildings right there on the Smithsonian Mall, but we also have offices around the country and around the world.
USDA is a big place with an expansive mission. Merrigan elaborates how her department makes a difference.
Well, the budget is about $145 billion. What people don't realize is that nearly two-thirds of that budget is for nutrition assistance programs. So people think USDA, they think farmers, ranchers, but actually we do food stamps, which is a supplemental nutrition assistance program. We are involved in the school meals programs, the National School Lunch Program, for example. So really, the bulk of our money is going to nutrition assistance. We are somewhere in the range of 114,000 FTEs. We are the fifth largest employer in the federal government.
Dr. Merrigan explains her role within the department and the challenges she faces.
As deputies are, they are alter egos to their secretaries. So I am there to advise, first and foremost, Secretary Vilsack on everything that comes before the department. Specifically, I am in charge of the budget process, budget formulation, tracking where the money goes, which is increasingly taking up time in this environment. I have a particular role in this administration to lead efforts on building local and regional food systems. Because of my background coming in, my interest, Secretary Vilsack asked me to lead an initiative. Coming in as a political appointee, I'm very cognizant of the sand running through the hourglass. That is a challenge not only for me, but all senior executives with all the things that are pressing upon us. How do we really have laser focus and know how to manage our time to those priorities? I think it's a really challenging institution to manage, USDA, because of the breadth of what it does and the challenge of the disconnect of what Americans know about American agriculture, because less than 1% of Americans now have experience, direct experience, being on the farm or the ranch. They don't really understand the broad mission of USDA. So we really have a sales job that we have to do both to the American people and to other policymakers here inside the Beltway.
How is USDA connecting people to its varied mission while promoting the country's agriculture? Here's Deputy Secretary Dr. Kathleen Merrigan.
Rural America has been in an economic freefall long before the rest of the economy. And when we came into this administration, Secretary Vilsack, former two-term governor of Iowa, was very cognizant of the problems in rural America, the infrastructure needs, the lower incomes, the difficulty to access health care. We came into this administration saying we can't do everything. We have to have some strategies. One strategy is broadband access. If people had more broadband access in rural America, that would help with telemedicine, it would help with rural schools, and it certainly would help with entrepreneurialism. Small businesses of all kinds could be created. We're very focused on local and regional food systems as a way of creating job opportunities in rural America. There is a fervor in this country around local and regional foods that creates an opportunity. If we can help build some of that infrastructure that the smaller scale farmers could use to deliver local foods, that's a strategy that we're really high on. There's a lot of emphasis in this administration on green jobs, renewable energy specifically. And we're also very excited about recreation opportunities in our national forests and parklands. Finally, we're really high on ecosystem markets. We need to come up with ecosystem markets where farmers and ranchers and others get a benefit from using their resources in a way that helps overall ecosystem development. So when we talk about the Farm Safety Net at USDA, we have to be talking about more than disaster assistance programs. It's more than just that farm product. At the end of the day, it's about the vitality in those rural communities and whether people are going to run or raise a family there.
In the end, it's all about cultivating the vitality of every community, from rural to urban. In an era of fiscal constraint, marked by shrinking budgets and increasing demand on government services, government executives are confronted with very difficult choices. This situation is ever more acute in the delivery of human services to those most in need. Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor of Health and Human Services for the City of New York, spoke to us about how the city effectively delivers health and human services and the size and breadth of her portfolio.
It's pretty big. So it's about $20 billion of services provided by 9 different agencies. It runs from things that affect everybody in the city. Broadly, I think of it as the helping services for the city. We have a set of safety net services that can help people when a crisis arises and can structure our services in a way that can leave them sort of stronger and better off after that intervention happens.
Creating a more holistic approach to human service delivery can be quite challenging, as Linda Gibbs, Deputy Mayor of HHS for New York City, outlines.
You can't ever take your eye off the ball, is you constantly got to be problem spotting, right? Sort of the added value and the obligation is to help anticipate problems before they happen, head them off at the pass so that you don't have a crisis, right?
Anticipating problems and finding new ways to solve them is key, especially in an era of fiscal constraint.
We lost our state and federal funding as a result of some state budget cuts, and we're left with the question of what are we going to do in order to deal with this crisis that's going to happen. From my point of view, the best way to do that kind of sort of thinking and problem spotting is you got to like create safe places for the experts who do the work and who know the dynamics to talk and to say what they think might happen and to let them. And so it's got to be sort of no bad ideas in this room, right? So it's like by having a healthy conversation, you can usually identify the problems and at least have strategies for getting to them. That is the worst when you have a crisis that was an avoidable crisis.
New York City relies heavily on the nonprofit sector to deliver social services. It has a special relationship with this sector and has worked with nonprofits to navigate the recession. New York City Deputy Mayor Gibbs elaborates.
It's true that the social service nonprofit organizations are really critical in delivering frontline services. But in New York City, we are probably even more deeply dependent to thousands of nonprofit organizations that are the real folks that are delivering the services. We've had an extraordinarily productive and I think exciting set of initiatives that we've been rolling out in the city that are focused on nonprofit management and nonprofit improvement. And so it falls into a couple of categories. One is really focusing on how to help nonprofits be strong and resilient, an initiative we call Greater New York. And the focus of this initiative is really to improve the strength of nonprofit leadership and management, and to do that with technical assistance and a strong partnership with a successful business sector partner. Another really critical part is just helping nonprofits understand whether, you know, are they the good, the bad, or the ugly? We've developed a whole, again, through the use of technology, developing a set of indicators for nonprofits around their health, fiscal health, staffing, organizational, client service outcome health. The great thing about this is that it is actually connected to an initiative we have to streamline procurement in the cities.
The medical mission of the U.S. Department of Defense is to enhance DOD and the country's security by providing health support for a full range of military operations. It does this through its military health system. Dr. Jonathan Woodson, Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, explains.
The military health system is a worldwide enterprise. This year, we're looking at a budget of about $52.5 billion. And the military health system is made up of a large number of components. So we are obviously responsible for combat casualty care, but we're also responsible for what we call garrison care, which is a routine care anybody would receive, similar to that of a civilian sector with hospitals and clinics, primary care clinics.
Doing this requires significant resources and a focused and strategic leader. Here's Dr. Woodson on his efforts to make a difference.
We have about 140,000 folks who work within the MHS, but we have a network of over 350 to 380,000 practitioners who provide care to our people through the integrated networks that are established. So it's hospitals, it's clinics, it's combat casualty care, it's research, it's academics, it's a full-service health enterprise. As the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, I am the principal advisor to the Secretary of Defense on all matters related to